Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Now, here's a segment from March of 2010. Sometimes I sit and look at the ocean, and way out on the horizon, I see a large cargo ship going by. And because I'm a boater, I understand how complex a ship is. It's a microcosm between the engines and the electrical and the plumbing and the hydraulics, let alone the knowledge you have to navigate. The captain, a good captain, should theoretically be able to fix a broken boiler or fix a circuit that goes out in an electrical system. He shouldn't have to do it, but he should understand every system on the ship in order to be a competent captain, right? Why should the captain of a ship also know how, for example, if a pipe blows, how to fix that pipe? Because in an emergency, what if the person who's supposed to do that fails or is incompetent or gets sick? And that's why a competent captain should know all systems of a ship, including navigation. It's the same with a nation. The good ship of state, the U.S., is in the hands of an inexperienced man, almost a college teacher. A left-wing radical college teacher has been given the captainship of this great nation. He doesn't know the first thing about navigation. All he knows is the rhetoric that's been put in his head by Reverend Wright. Hate America, white man is bad, African nationalism. You name it. This is what's going on between his ears behind the scenes in one man's opinion. And so what is the navigational tool that Obama's using? What's driving Obama? What sea is he on? Do you think he's really on the sea of patriotism? Do you think he really cares about America's place in history? Do you actually think he came to office wanting to make this a better nation? Or do you think he came to office wanting to make this into a different nation? A nation that conforms to his biased, warped, left-wing worldview. The kind of radical left-wing garbage that many of you had to put up with in college is now driving policy in the United States of America. And it's being run by people who can't navigate, fix the electrical system, couldn't fix a rudder that went out, wouldn't know how to turn a wheel. They're running us in directions that this country was never intended to go. The people never wanted it to go in this direction. The people don't even understand the danger they're in. It's like having a teenager who has carjacked a car and is racing around the streets with it. That's how I feel with Obama. I sometimes look at him and I see a kid, like a teenager, with his ears sticking out, and I see him racing around going, "Wee! What fun I'm having." Racing around with the good ship America. Joyriding with the good ship America without any thought about where he is going or where the people want us to go. The nation of governed? The will of the governed? It doesn't even enter his mind. He's answering to a few hundred people that he knows in his geography, the geography of his mind. The geography of his mind is all on the far left of the spectrum. That's all he answers to. Now, you know, you can't understand this unless you understand it. What if a right-winger had won the election on a small majority of the vote, ran as a centrist, and then started hiring people from the Ku Klux Klan to be his czars? What if this right-winger had done the very opposite of what Obama's doing and started enacting one right-wing policy after another? What do you think the people would be doing today? Did you know that Obama announced that he's giving up even more nuclear weapons to Russia? 30% of our nuclear weapons are going to be destroyed under Obama. Does anyone understand the danger this man is putting us in? I don't give a damn what you think of me. I'm going to tell you right now, you better wake up. You have a group of insane people running this country. No, I don't think they're smart. No, I don't think that they have the best interests of America at heart, as Peggy Noonan apparently does. Little old curtsy Peggy Noonan, curtsying all the way to the gallows. Peggy Noonan curtsying, telling everyone to cool the rhetoric. Listen, Pat Noonan, you ought to stop curtsying so much and get a pair of daggers in your pen. Peggy Noonan, another one. Another one who's saying that talk radio is responsible for the heated rhetoric in America, that the administration is not responsible for any of the heated rhetoric in the United States of America. I couldn't believe I was reading this column. Now, Peggy Noonan is a has-been. We know that. Nobody has her on their show anymore. But, all right, there's a certain grace and dignity in the old guard Republican world, sort of like the level of Nancy Reagan that you try to respect. But when I read her column today, and she says the Democrat officials are right to call attention to what they believe is a growing threat. It is a truly terrible thing. Then she goes on, and she says the following. She says the country is very angry about a million things. And most of these things, she said, were not the fault of the administration. And she goes on to what they're angry at. And then she says their anger is stoked by cynical politicians. Excuse me, Peggy Noonan. You mean by politicians who finally had the nerve to stand up to the communism of Obama? That makes them cynical? What does that make you, Peggy? It makes you a fellow traveler with the socialists, Peggy Noonan. You've always been a check pants Republic girl. You've always been a country club Republican girl, and it's time for you to stop hiding behind the curtsying, Peggy. We recognize who you are. For you to attack the politicians who dare stand up to Obama and then say radio ranters are stirring the hatred tells us which side you are on. No, Peggy, we're the ones who are trying to save America from people like you. Ladies and gentlemen, this country's in very grave danger, in my opinion. Call me what you'd like, but I'm often right. When I see him passing socialized medicine that even Fidel Castro approves of, and the mainstream media doesn't even report that Castro sent them a congratulatory message, and I've been telling you for months now that the fourth estate has become the fifth column. I've almost been a man alone until others joined in and stole it from me. The problem is very deep. But the problem is deeper than just the shallow idiots on the conservative side of the aisle. Yes, you heard me right. The shallow, uneducated dolts on the conservative side of the aisle. They're part of the problem, but they're not the real problem. The problem is Obama. Obama is a diehard, hardcore, far-left communist, period, in my opinion. End of story. Now, if you don't like what I just said, prove me wrong. Al Sharpton came out, the genius, the philosophical genius from the streets of Harlem. The genius of Harlem, a highly educated man with a very distinguished history, comes out and says, "You all voted for socialized medicine. What are you complaining about?" He said that. Then Castro sends Obama a thank you note for bringing in a wonderful health care system, and the media doesn't report it. And so, therefore, we have a communist revolution in the United States of America. One brick at a time, they're building a new edifice, a new America. And when you wake up from your damn slumber, you won't have a country left. And I blame everyone listening to the show. You had a chance to stop this man. You had a chance to throw McCain out on his malarkey butt. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. You know, in the healthcare thing, right? It was all Democrats, zero Republicans. That's a given. Okay, no Republican would have stepped on a third rail there. With immigration reform, meaning pathway to citizenship for 30 million illegal aliens, mainly Hispanics, La Raza, Mikey predicts at least 40, if not 70 Republicans will cross over to the other side and turn their coat and vote with the Democrats. It'll be a slam dunk. Now, why do I say it? Hello? Because John McCain spoke to La Raza in 08 and 09. John McCain kissed the butt of every Hispanic rallier he could find for three straight years, and it cost him the election anyway. Moreover, I did my homework for you. Unlike what you'd think that I just get up here and talk. We checked who voted for amnesty for illegals in 2006 on the Republican side. Oh, it's a nice list here. Republican senators, Bennett, Brownback, Chafee, Coleman, Collins, Craig, DeWine, Domenici, Frist. Remember him, Bill Frist? Where is Bill Frist now that we don't need him? Graham, Gregg, Hagel, Lugar, Martinez, McCain, McConnell, Murkowski, Smith, Snow, Specter, Stevens, Voinovich, Warner. Now, they're not all still sitting Republican senators. Now they're just standing Republican lobbyists. But they voted. The bill passed in the Senate but didn't make it out of the conference committee. And it did not become law. This bill would have established a citizenship path for illegal immigrants, giving 30 million people the vote and all the freebies that you worked for all your life that you don't have. So I'm telling you right now, Bennett, Brownback, Collins, Graham, Gregg, Lugar, McCain, McConnell, Murkowski, Snow, at the least, are going to vote for it in the Senate. That's already 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 senators. Now you take those 10 senators and you throw them in the Dems. Bingo, it's over. Hello, Mexico. Hello, Mexico. Didn't you always want to live in sunny Mexico? They have such a superb government down there. The people have such unlimited freedoms and there's no crime in Mexico. Land of beauty where gardenias grow, Mexico, Mexico. Where? Guys, no, I'm whacked out tired today. I'm exhausted. I didn't have my nap. You know, I used to like National Geographic. And they publish an article now, National Geographic. Global warming making people more aggressive. And they write a whole article, a construct out of nothing. That temperature changes can influence human behavior and some liberal whack job on the Symposium of Social Psychology. Anyone who has a degree in social psychology to begin with is a D student. Anyone who got an advanced degree in social psychology is already half crazy. They should have just stayed on welfare smoking medical marijuana. Symposium on Social Psychology. Global warming is influencing behavior. Brad Bushman at the University of Michigan, who specializes in human aggression, said hot temperatures make people cranky and irritable. Ooh, there's a Nobel in that. And he says cranky and irritable people are prone to aggression. So their thesis is that global warming could heighten aggression. And then they write in mumbo jumbo. Here's another one. Ihor Boyanovsky, a criminal psychologist at so-called Simon Fraser University in so-called Canada, says, my own research has shown that elevated ambient temperatures lead to increased brain temperatures that result in cognitive dysfunction, emotional stress and aggression, and to higher levels of violent crime, said Boyanovsky. So in other words, hot climates produce more violence. Does that mean folks from hot climates are more violent? And therefore, the reverse is true, that people from cold climates are less violent? So Europeans are less violent than people, let us say, from Africa? Would that be the thesis? Ooh, they fell into it. So in other words, their bias in the racial world has come up against their desire to fraudulently induce you to believe that global warming is going to bring the world to an end. This thesis of anthropogenic global warming is literally bringing some pseudoscience to the surface that is it would be comic if it wasn't going to be destructive. Anyway, I thought I'd share that with you. Medical marijuana in California. There isn't enough stupidity in California. There aren't enough stupid people in San Francisco. There aren't enough dummies walking around half psycho in California. They need more reason to get stoned. More reason to be stoned all the time. Walk around even more stoned. Make yourself less reactive to human beings. Make yourself even more cut off from humanity. Make yourself more of a puppet of the government. You know, I watched the marijuana thing about they're going to legalize it in California. And I see a guy speaking on the side of legalization. I'm one of the few people in the country know who he is. He's funded by George Soros. You don't know that George Soros funded both initiatives both in California and in Arizona a few years back to legalize marijuana. Now, put aside for the minute whether or not you think it should be legal. Why would George Soros, money manipulator extraordinaire, worldwide socialist, the man who was allegedly behind implanting Obama into the White House, why would he want more people stoned rather than fewer people stoned? Don't even answer the question. The answer is in the question. That's the kind of show I run. Since you're not in the audience with me, you're not here, you can't raise your hand. You know why he wants more of you stoned, so that more of you can be duped by an increasingly autocratic administration. so that more of you can be led along by the nose down the primrose path of slavery. And so I see the guy from the one of the groups that that Soros funded glowing about legalization. I actually had a heated exchange with him a couple of years ago, and I called him every name under the sun. I showed him the scientific evidence which proves that marijuana is medically harmful. Let's put aside moral, I don't care. I really don't care if you get stoned. I don't really care if you get stoned, truthfully. It doesn't matter to me. But it's medically very dangerous. It has more cancer-causing agents than cigarettes do. I'm not making this up. I could be stupid enough to get stoned on marijuana. The tars that you are so afraid of with big tobacco and tobacco. The carbon monoxide that you find in cigarettes. Other toxins that you're just so sensitive to, all of you good lefties. You're getting much more of it from marijuana. On top of it all, and I've told you this 10 years ago because I'm trained in the field, much of the marijuana in this country is laden with mercury. All you liberal, sensitive creatures, you. All of you sensitive vegetarians out there who wouldn't put any ugly, dirty meat in your mouth and you eat organic. You're sucking tailpipes when you smoke marijuana. You know, this whole thing about medical marijuana is a fraud because, frankly, you can get the same benefits from THC. If it's so wonderful and you get relief from marijuana, you're getting the relief from tetrahydrocannabinol, not from the marijuana cigarette. It's all about getting high. This was a fraud to legalize it. I've heard all the arguments. I mean, I'd like to see marijuana decriminalized, truthfully, but not disseminated widely. And if it is disseminated widely, I think it has to have very serious warning labels attached to it so that children are not duped into becoming potheads. It will destroy their lives. I have never met anyone who smoked pot who is a reliable human being. Some of them are successful. Listen to what I just said. Reliable human being. Some of them are very rich, but not reliable. Just ask their children. Or look at their children and see what their children have become. Some of them are very rich. It doesn't mean they're reliable. And I will tell you, it destroys a human being. It's a horrible drug. It's perhaps the most insidious of all drugs because people think it's innocuous. Mark Masters, Talk Radio Network, and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when? 2000?
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
I was very lucky because I had a classical high school education before I went to college and grad school. And this was Jamaica High School, Queens, New York. In those days, it was a tough school. And we had to learn a language. Then in college, I had to learn two languages to get through Queens College. You had to learn them and examine them, believe it or not. Today, you don't even have to speak English to get through Queens College. In fact, if you speak English, you're considered a racist at most colleges today. If you speak English too well, you're probably investigated by the Department of Homeland Security. Anyone who speaks English too well is looked upon as somewhat suspect by the TSA. They get a double frisking. What a country we live in. It's like an upside-down world to me. I'm like, you know, you know, it's another world, you know. Rip Van Savage here. The reason I mentioned the Greek gods is because in high school, I had to learn the Greek gods. In high school, we had to be somewhat familiar with the Greek gods. So you say, well, what do you need that crap for? Well, no, would you rather learn the rap artists with gold teeth or bling in their nostrils? Now, why did we have to study the Greek gods? Well, because the Greek mythological culture had a lot to do with Western literature. Greek mythological literature. And some of you would know some of the names. For example, Aphrodite. If I say Aphrodite, the average person who's read anything would know who Aphrodite was. Or if I say the gods such as, let me name some of the Greek gods, okay? And some of you know it because you've had, you know, good educations. You don't have to be a scholar to know what these mean. But the average person in my day would have known who these deities were. Ancient gods and modern faces. You say, well, I don't want to know that I'm a Christian or I'm Jewish. I don't even want to hear it. It doesn't mean that you have to worship the ancient gods in order to be an educated person. You should know a lot of things that you don't have to follow. I mean, you could know how an addict puts heroin in his arm. It doesn't mean you have to shoot heroin in your arm, for example. You know, don't be so afraid of learning. Learning isn't so terrifying. So the gods of Greece are an interesting subject, which you'll see where I'm going to get to in a minute. Who are they? Poseidon, Apollo, Artemis, Aphrodite, Dionysus, Zeus, Athena, Hera, Hestia, Ares, Hephaestus, Demeter, Hades, Hermes. Some of these you probably have some familiarity. Everyone listening to this show has heard the name Zeus, right? Or you saw a movie, The Poseidon Adventure, so you know what Poseidon. Poseidon, Aphrodite. Okay, if I say Aphrodite, what do you think of? I'm not interested in Aphrodite. Today I'm interested in Dionysus, because Dionysus rose from the depths of ancient civilization and tore the Apollonian order apart. Dionysus was also known as Bacchus. He was the god of pleasure, basically. And as you well know, our society today is given over to pleasure to the extent that Bacchus or Dionysus would be the god that would probably rule America, other than Jesus or God himself. And our civilization is now crumbling as a result of the Dionysian elements that are within man, that have been somewhat controlled, that have now broken free or been let out of the cage, so to speak. As early as 186 before Christ, the Roman Senate actually issued a proclamation that suppressed all Bacchic societies throughout Italy as a conspiracy against the state. Now look where we've come to today. Look where we've come today. Take a look at where we are today, where Bacchus or Dionysus is revered, held up as the role model. And, you know, these were considered at a certain time something to be suppressed, kept underground, kept in the hidden background. And we were supposed to be rigid and self-controlled, right? Well, the question is, what's the balance? What's the balance point? Is it to let yourself go completely? No, because you wind up like that actor, whatever his name was, who was the cocaine and the hooker a few weeks ago. You don't want to be like him. Or the slut girls of Hollywood. In my day, even if they were like that, they made believe that they were ladies. Today, they hide the ladyhood in them, because the degenerates who run Hollywood want their women. They actually hate women. You don't understand this. It's something that's very hard for you to understand. The degenerates who run Hollywood hate women. And so, therefore, they want women to debase themselves with drugs, with alcohol, and with sexuality. Don't you understand how this works? The degenerates hate women. So, therefore, any woman who is debased in that manner, they put up on a pedestal. That's how I see it. And so, that's I'm talking about this, right? So, madness, violence, wildness, terror, God's double nature. Is liberalism about liberation? Is liberalism about liberation? Yes, to the child, to the average child, they think that liberals stand for liberation, ecstasy, and inspiration, and they think that a conservative stands for the opposite. But in fact, your daughter is more likely to wind up in the hands of those bringing about madness, violence, wildness, and terror as a result of the liberalism that is now raging through the universities. Do you understand that? Okay. So that's what we're talking about. So which way do you want your children to go? Do you want them to be overly rigid? You can't raise a child that way today. Cannot do it. If you do, they're going to rebel and they're going to go the opposite way. On the other hand, if you're going to let them just, you know, don't do anything I wouldn't do, that kind of child rearing. You ever hear those parents, the Marin County, Upper East Side women? Oh, well, honey, don't do anything I wouldn't do, they say to the daughter at 14. So the daughter doesn't do anything she wouldn't do, and the daughter's in rehab at 14 and a half. That's all. Goes out with a pair of pants on her. I mean, it's unbelievable to me the way they walk around today. Poor women. Poor women. I see children today. I'm just rambling. Today I'm a rambling man. Last week, I almost did a whole show last week about my feelings about children. I look at children when I see them and I feel bad for them. Little children. I feel bad for them. I look at them and my heart hurts for them. I know you say, well, what are you giving to the bleeding heart? What are you, a bleeding heart liberal or something? No, if I see kids, there's a lot of children in the Marin County area, and I divide my time between a number of different communities. And this is a rookery out here. many of the liberal white families flee the city of San Francisco once they have children in order to give them an education where they won't be mugged and have their clothing robbed and their lunch money stolen. And so they come out to the truth. I mean, you want me to, you know, to talk about it. They come to the safe white suburbs. I don't blame them. They're afraid to raise their kids where the kid is going to be mauled. So anyway, they're here. And they continue their liberalism here. But you see the children. And I look at children 3, 4, 5, and they're running, and they're just average. You know, like any child through the ages, any race, any culture. But I look at them, and I say, what future is waiting for these kids? You know, when you have a government that is so avaricious that it will really put into debt children unto the fourth generation of this country in order to aggrandize themselves and hold on to power, they'll bankrupt us unto the fourth generation. I look at these children and I fear for them. But it's not only the monetary element that I worry about. I mean, that is a bad one, but that's not what I'm really getting at. I fear that they're going to wind up slaves. I swear to God, my guts tell me these little white children are going to wind up enslaved by the third world. And I have reason to say that to you. And the reason is that the white liberal would like to see the people of this country enslaved. They say that we exploited the world, we exploited the resources of the world, and that to them there's nothing that a third worlder can't do, that cannot do, that's not good. And there's nothing that an American can do that is good. Nothing. And so they say, well, it's turnaround, it's fair game. And they'd like to see the children in this country turned into little slaves. And that's what I fear. So you say, well, come on, that's absurd. We have the strongest military on earth. What is the good of a strong military when you have men like Robert Gates, the defense secretary, who gives a speech and says, quickly, hush, hush, pass, don't ask, don't tell, while the Congress is not in session. This is a man who's cut one military expenditure after another that has to do with weapon systems, and now he's spending all of his time trying to push don't ask, don't tell. Why don't you ask the men who are actually taking the bullets what they think about don't ask, don't tell? Don't ask me. Ask them what they think it'll do to the military. Well, let's go another step. I read last week that the geniuses under Obama are now going to put women on submarines. Now, I ask you something. I'm going to ask you something. I know there are brave women. I've met them. I've seen helicopter pilots who are women. I understand that there are women who can be as fine a pilot as a man. But don't you understand what happens when you put a woman on a submarine? Do you understand what's going to happen on that submarine where you have a tight, cohesive group that works together like a well-oiled machine, and you're going to put 5 women on a submarine? You're going to tell me there's not going to be a little vying for that woman? That's exactly what they want. They want to wreck the unit cohesion. And they want lawsuits. And let me tell you something else. If it's a choice between another torpedo and a toilet, they're going to build that toilet, and they're going to eliminate that torpedo tube. That's why I wrote Trickle-Up Poverty, Obama's War on Our Borders, Economy, and Security, stupid. Wake up. It's all planned. Savage. I'm shy of bookstores. I don't go into bookstores for a number of reasons. I haven't for many years, which is a shame. I used to, a writer should live in bookstores, right? I used to love bookstores, but all right, so I stopped going. But now that I have a raging bestseller, Trickle Up Poverty, I went into my local Barnes & Noble. I was dressed somewhat like a homeless person, which is my normal garb during the week. I bicycle, you see, and when I bicycle, I like to wear old clothing. I don't wear any kind of jester costumes. I leave that to the fools who wear jester costumes on bicycles and show you their butt as they cut you off and wave a hammer at you to break your mirror. So I wear old clothes, I mean, because they're comfortable if you fall. You know what I mean? There's a little water on the ground. I swear to God, so I have one jacket that's 20 years old that I wear. I like it. It's padded if I fall, So I go in with the helmet, the glasses, the sweatshirt under the helmet. I look like, the Unabomber. And with sunglasses, and no one, of course, knows me, thank God, because I'm not a TV guy. And I go to the bestseller rack, and there's my book, and it was a pleasure. Over comes the manager. Under the garb, she apparently recognized me, and she says, Michael, it's so nice to see you here. I was shocked. that she knew me at all. I mean, I'm a local author, but I never make it. I'm not one of these guys who reads his books and, you know, the postmenopausal crowd and all that. So she was an African-American lady, the nicest woman you could ever believe running a major league bookstore. And I wouldn't say she was a fan of the show. I didn't even ask her that. She was just a woman knowledgeable about the book business. She said, let me tell you a story. A woman came in last week into this store, and she got in my face, and she yelled at me. And she said, you put that book in that slot where it belonged. And she said it was funny because your listeners are fanatic about this. They won't stop demanding, you know, the right placement in this and that. I thought that was pretty amazing. So anyway, big deal. So I took a picture with a cell phone camera. I had to take a picture finally in front of a book thing. I felt comfortable enough to go to the magazine stand. I don't know how bookstores make money, by the way, because it's filled with deadbeats who sit there all day long reading magazines for free, and then they put them back in the rack all wrinkled up. I feel bad about it. Like, I grew up in a time, I'm even afraid to touch a magazine because it was considered cheating. When I was a kid, if you went into a candy store and you looked at a comic, the guy behind the counter would practically tear your hands off if you read it for free. You remember those days? Who would have the nerve to go into a candy store and look at, let's say, a comic book for nothing? How would you expect a guy to make a living? So it was understood that it was like a social contract. If you went into a store to look at a comic book as a kid, I was trained, my father would say, you buy it, don't read it for free. That's cheating. So I paid the nickel or the dime. Now you got people in there, mainly liberals with gray beards. They got nothing to do. They're unemployed or probably retired professors, who knows. And they sit around looking scruffier than I, reading the magazines. So today I went in and I read the magazines. I did buy a few. You know, it's funny. You can tell a man by the magazines he reads. Let me tell you what I bought. I bought Flying Magazine. I bought several boating magazines. I bought Hemmings Motor News. I bought some classic car magazine. Something, you know, like cars and stuff like that. Magazines are a lot of pleasure. They're very relaxing. In addition to being interesting, they're very relaxing. Why Flying Magazine? I don't fly. I've always wanted to be a pilot. I can't fly. I don't have the skill for it. I can boat. I mean, I drive a 40-ton boat without any water, but I can't fly a plane. I'm thinking of taking up flying lessons now at my age. Who knows? Why not? I mean, a lot of people do it. I mean, when you think about it, I'd rather die in a plane crash than die of cancer or a heart attack. Symbol shot. Have you thought about that? I mean, do you really want to sit and wait to go to the assisted living with the teeth falling out and have an illegal immigrant beat you up for your small change when your family leaves you there in the last years of your life as they push you into a corner facing an old curtain and you can't move? It's a horrible way to die. They beat you about the head and neck and, you know, take your money. It's worse than a TSA agent. What happens to the old people in assisted living is worse than what happens in an airport screening today. We can go to the magazines I bought in the bookstore. So in front of me, I have Hemmings Motor News, Plane and Pilot for this month. Plane and Pilot, the magazine for active piston engine pilots. Yachting Magazine, let's see, Innovative Design Trends, Winter Charter Escape to the Virgin Islands. Is the St. Barth's Bucket the ultimate regatta? And then I have PMY, that's not PMS, PMY, Power and Motor Yacht, America's 100 largest yachts. I don't really want a big boat like that. I never dreamed of it. I don't want it. I'm not one of the, I don't like people that much where I want to be with a crowd on a boat. See, that's the problem with a large boat, is you kind of go with a group and show off. I don't understand. I mean, I'm not a party guy. Maybe that's why I'm not that happy. I don't know. Maybe I should be a party guy with a couch and champagne and drugs and starlets. But at this point in my life, I don't think I'm going to change horses in midstream. So America's 100 largest yachts, and they list them. You know who owns the biggest yacht in the world? Where is it? Oh, it's number 7, Musashi, at 288 feet? Oh, sorry. America's 100 largest yacht. Who gets the biggest? Here it is, Rising Sun. 452 feet, built by Lürssen Shipyards in Germany. Octopus at 414 feet. Number 3 is a Le Grand Bleu, 370 foot. Limitless. You know, that's pretty amazing. It's a men do these things to show who's bigger, so to speak. I guess if you have unlimited money, there are very few ways to do it. It says, in the yacht spotting world, the most exciting news is often unconfirmed. Blah, 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 blah. All of this combined makes FedShip's launch of Musashi even more intriguing. Hints as to her owner's identity include her Japan-influenced name. Musashi was a 16th-century samurai, and her exterior styling. These clues point to Larry Ellison as the owner. Ellison is a known penchant for all things Japanese. So, I mean, does that matter? Whatever. Famous owner, this and that. How do you entertain yourself on a show? I don't understand it. I have a family member who enjoys this, by the way. You see what happens is I've gotten older. It's not that I've gotten more tolerant. I've gotten more of an understanding of people in the sense that it goes back to the 60s, different strokes for different folks. You know what I'm saying? If you enjoy being on a ship with 10 friends, having a good time, God bless you. I don't. I have a large boat, but I handle it alone. To me, the idea of going out is me and the dog. Why? Because I talk for a living. I don't want to go on a boat and talk for 10 days. And this, the idea of getting off the boat with the launch and going ashore and going to another dinner and seeing other nouveau riche, you know, everyone's showing. Well, all right, maybe if you're in a different state of mind, it's entertaining for a while. But I never wanted the James Bond lifestyle. I don't think, maybe I'm lying to myself. I don't know. Who knows? You know, you got to ask yourself, because as a kid, I loved sports cars. I was fascinated by fast cars and slow women. I mean, I loved sports. You remember that joke? That joke went the other way. But today, I like fast cars, but I drive them slowly. Let's put it to you that way. I've become the guy with the fast car in the middle lane doing 63 and a half miles an hour. I don't even enjoy speeding. What's the point? I mean, the sound of an engine, a great engine like in a Ferrari at 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 RPM is something to behold. But you can do that in the garage with the engine in neutral if you just want to hear the engine making noise. I mean, speed is a very dangerous thing on a regular road, so I tend to stay within the speed limit.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Now, here's a segment from March of 2010. Rammstein, give me Rammstein. Right. Think of this music when you think of Obama. The next time you think of John Dingell, sing this in your head.
Deine Größe macht mich klein. Du darfst mein Bestrafer sein.
The only way to survive in this country is if the entire nation that opposes Obama, which is probably 30 million people, became one gigantic entity, one gigantic organization. We're disorganized. Oh, yes, you have the Tea Parties, but they have been disorganized by the Republican Party, in my opinion, mainly by Dick Armey, who put out his own Tea Party in order to basically weaken the entire thrust of the movement, co-opt it, and take it over, and make it into an appendage of the Republican Party. Sarah Palin even said it. She said to the Tea Party people, you're not a party. Okay, you're not a party. Vote for us. You can't vote for anyone else. Then she went for the biggest contract she can get. I don't blame her, but, I mean, let's not fool ourselves into thinking she's going to lead you to victory, man. She's not Joan of Arc. She's not Moses. You're going to part the Red Sea. That's interesting. Red Sea. Part the Red Sea. Part the Red Sea. Biblical interpretation. Parting the Red Sea. So Obama has flooded America with a Red Sea. Interesting. Someone has to lead us through the Red Sea. Who's going to part the Red Sea? It isn't me. Who is going to part the Red Sea? It is not me. Perhaps it is thee. Who is going to part the Red Sea? You know what I should do on this show one of these days is have a drink before I'm off the air. You know, in my entire 16-year career, I did it only once. I tried it once. I tried it 4 minutes before the end of a show. It was horrible. You ever want to listen to a drunk on the air? I mean, even a drink destroys your focus. Do you know, you realize how powerful alcohol is? You don't really know it if you're like in a relaxed state. All right, it's 5 o'clock. I think I'll have a few drinks, watch the sun go down. Let's say you're into that phase of your life, you know. That's one thing. But let's say you're a performer or you're a race car driver, jet pilot, boxer, whatever. One drink will throw your coordination off to such an extent that virtually you'll kill your career. And there is a reason that you should not be able to drink. Of course, in World War II, they drank before flying. World War II, the samurai who flew the planes, the kamikaze, all had sake before they flew. Didn't hurt them. It's nonsense to think you can't drink if you're going into combat. I think that you should drink before going into combat. I think it's insane not to have a few drinks before going into combat. You know what I mean? You know, you think about that. But we're talking about not coming, like body, man to man. Who's going to drink before going into combat, whether it's on radio or in a ring? Why am I saying? Because I'm tired of the healthcare thing already. Look at the calls I got to deal with. The illegals and steps to dictatorship, student loan takeover, Obama and Jim Jones. Why doesn't anyone use real illegal numbers? This hasn't broken me. It's empowered me. To my website. See the infamous Savage Schmuck ad TV stations would not run. It is funny. They wouldn't run it in San Francisco. They had to run the non-schmuck ad. Let's see. Letter of thanks from girlfriend of Lieutenant Michael Behenna. Not funny. Murderously horrendous to believe that why this man is locked up for 15 years for doing his job. The guy's like a movie star, an American hero. And you don't care about it. What can I do? I mean, I've done all I can do. It's like one man against the wind. I have my own troubles and I care about others. Why? See, you don't know that about me. I never met Behenna. I don't make any money from it. But this guy's in jail. This is real. Trying to do our best. He sent them over 200 grand, I think, all of us, 150. Keep sending the money. I'll send it on to him. I don't take a dime. I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do where they have to answer to a lower authority. New Jersey town out to ban dog barking. Oh, I love that law. Oh, I love it. Piscataway, New Jersey, as officials try to put dog owners on a financial leash if they can't keep their pets quiet. Oh, thank God. If they would outlaw fireplaces in the suburban neighborhoods and in the cities and barbecues and dog barking, I'd live in Nirvana. I swear to me, those are my three pet peeves of my whole life. Barbecues. I mean, they get stomach cancer from it, but they don't know. Barbecue. Like heathens. I mean, I don't mind once in a while a barbecue. I know schmucks every night in the neighborhood I live in California. Every night the schmuck has a barbecue on. You could, your eyes singe. I had one neighbor drop dead of stomach cancer. I didn't exactly. This went on for 5 years. The smoke would come in my house. I would sit there mumbling, you should get. Unfortunately, he got it. Died of stomach cancer. Terrible thing. Who would eat polycyclic hydrocarbons every night and not expect to get some kind of cancer? Except a dumb moron liberal. Now, I know it has nothing to do with politics. Many people think that barbecued meat is the American way. Why, Mike, you're really a commie tonight. That's the American way, the barbecue. You want to outlaw everything, Mike? What are you suddenly going soft on? Just telling you, you want to eat barbecued food? Go ahead. Polycyclic hydrocarbons, you know, that black stuff that you like the taste of? Cancer. That's the taste. Cancer. You want to live long? Eat boiled food or don't cook it at all. How's that for a thought? You want to give yourself some simple rules? No preserved food, no barbecued food, boiled food or raw. That's a good start. That's number one. Now, barbecues are number one. Now, fireplace. Oh, yeah, they need a fireplace. The schmucks in the suburbs need a wood fire. I have a house down by the water in the Bay Area. These left-wing, they drive me crazy. They have peace signs on their front door, and at night they run a wood fire. It looks like a kiln in England. It's like a steel plant in England, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But in the morning, they're voting for global warming taxes, these idiots. They drive me crazy. Well, you can't have a gas fireplace? It wouldn't be the same? You moron, you? What are you, Davy Crockett? Why don't you just get the hat? Davy Crockett, that's your freedom to burn a wood fireplace. I don't mind if you're in the country. Burn what you want. But you're in a suburban neighborhood, you bum, you. You're 10 feet from your neighbor. You're poisoning everybody. That's number two, barbecue, fireplaces. Now I'll go to number three, dogs barking. I'm a dog lover. I own two dogs. They bark once in a while, okay. But I have sane dogs. I find that if people are crazy, their dogs are crazy. I find that people are mad dogs, their dogs bark. And I say arrest them. That's what I say. I say put the owners of the dog that barks in jail. That's what I say. I wouldn't go a step further, which I'd like to say, but I won't. What do you do with a guy who lets his dog out every morning to bark while you're sleeping? Well, who gives him the right to do that to you? So go for it. New Jersey town out to ban dog barking. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Now, here's a segment from March of 2010. I had no idea there were so many heroes in the cafeterias. All that tomato soup and when I was a kid in the Bronx, I hated tomato. Smell of tomato soup when I went in the cafeteria. I would retch from it. That smell of institutional soup. See, my day, they actually cooked the food. It wasn't brought in like a tray from McDonald's or wherever they bring it in from. Marriott Food Catering. In my day, they had like weird-looking women. Like, they were like out of like mental institutions working. Remember they looked like those dietitians. They didn't call dietitians. They worked in like the school kitchens. They were scary women. They were very pasty. They all looked like that they were like devil worshippers to me. I never wanted to touch any of their food, whatever they made, but that smell of the tomato soup. As I entered the PS49 in the Bronx, I think, whatever I went to. I go to the cafeteria like instant smacko migraine the minute I walked into the, that smell of the tomato soup. I mean, if you're repainting your car, okay, you take a quart home, spill it on the hood, wipe it in, and like, you know, it's Miracle Wipe, takes the paint right off. I don't know what they put in there. It must have been like excess government tomatoes from Italy or something after the war. That they bought tomatoes from the Italian. Who knows? They bought them underground tomatoes. They don't have them anymore, right? Now they're like basically from San Quentin. This new crop isn't even like wacky. I mean, they give ex-cons jobs. I don't believe they got to have a job. Look, nothing wrong with that. But they're all voters. Motor voters, you know. They're motor voters. So here we are. That smell of the chicken. I can still smell it. There was another smell that got me sick as a child. I'm thinking of like I'm doing my Proustian olfactory now. There's another smell from childhood that comes back. It's like Campbell's chicken noodle soup. It's like a mixed feeling. One homey, friendly. The other side, like MSG-ish, no good. Not equal to my mother's soup, which always gave me a migraine. And any soup that didn't give me a migraine, I didn't trust. Courtesy of Buddy Hackett. Now, he put it another way. I was raised on such bad food that I had no idea that food was... I didn't know what good food was. If food did not leave me slightly dyspeptic with a migraine, I thought it was a bad meal. It was so awful. I mean, it was high cholesterol, high salt. Impossible to believe they could feed a child food like that and not go to prison, you know, for child endangerment. I mean, you talk about school. It's no wonder I got a PhD in nutrition. I was like running for my life to try to figure out what had been done to me the previous 25 years. If you took a lab animal, let's say the arterial system in an animal that's closest to man is a pig or a rabbit, as I understand it, because I know that Dr. McCulley at Harvard used rabbits in the 1950s to induce atherosclerosis. He denied them vitamin B6. He diminished their diets in B6 and almost immediately gave them a hardening of the arteries. You don't know about that. Your doctor doesn't want you to know it. He only wants to put you on Lipitor so you become a cripple and need arthritis drugs. After you take the Lipitor-related compounds, you start walking around like your uncle, you know, with a killer. So Dr. McCulley used the rabbit. But if you took a rabbit or a pig and you put them, God rest the soul, on the diet I ate as a child, the animal's dead in 6 months. So it's actually a miracle. I mean, I must have some superpowers that I could overcome what I was force-fed. From childhood, foods that my body rejected. Even milk I hated. I hated milk. You have to have your milk. They put a clown thing on top of the glass of milk. Well, we have other stuff to talk about today. I'm just angry because last night I went to my... I'm never going to this Chinese restaurant again. It's not just that you risk your life crossing the street to get to that hellhole, But the guy behind the counter has the ugliest, meanest, most horrendous face I've ever seen in a restaurant. I lost my appetite. You know about fight or flight? This guy is the owner. There's two owners. One is nice and one is nasty. When I say nice, that's, of course, a qualified statement. I mean, he's not nasty, but that doesn't mean he's actually nice. He never smiles either. But this is either the brother or the brother-in-law. I actually hate going there when the brother-in-law's there. You remember the old Chuck Norris movies when they would liberate Americans from Vietnam, Vietnamese prison camps with the guard towers? Okay, picture this guy in a guard tower with an AK-47 and a conical hat. Now sit yourself down in a restaurant, and he's staring right at you as you eat, and he looks like he hates you, wants to poison you. There's no reason for you to be here. How dare you come in my restaurant? It is so... I don't know whether it's racist or he's just an evil, mean guy. So the meal was terrible, too. For those of you in San Francisco who go in the area, I am not naming any restaurant by name, but it's, and I wouldn't name it at all, but, you know, enough of that. So San Francisco, 860 on the dial. Giovanni, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to say thank you very much for your advice on taking niacin to control my triglycerides and my total HDL, and it's come out.
How much niacin are you taking a day?
Right now, I worked up to 2,500 milligrams a day, but I don't...
Unbelievable. You know, I myself, you won't believe it. You know, practice what you preach. I cannot take niacin. Do you know that if I take niacin, I get severe muscle aches the same way I would with one of the Lipitor-like compounds?
I know exactly what you mean. That's what happens.
It's terrible. I mean, I just can't live with it. So I decided I'm going to live until I die, and that's the end of it. I mean, there's quality. I don't want to limp around with low cholesterol. I can limp around with low cholesterol and walk around like a cripple. Or I can have high cholesterol and upside-down lipids and be able to run. But I'm glad it works for you. I mean, it's a miracle. Niacin, 3 grams a day. It'll reverse any of those cholesterol problems. And thank Abe Hoffer for that. He died last year, MD, PhD. One of the greatest unsung heroes in the history of medicine is Abe Hoffer. Do you know his story, Giovanni? Let me tell it on the Savage Nation. He died at about 90. He was a Canadian doctor, a lifetime believer in the good of man. In the early 50s, he discovered that niacin lowered cholesterol, and he had a choice to make. He said to me once, he said, I could patent this and make a fortune. Instead, he gave it to the world for free because he wanted the betterment of mankind instead. Would you believe this? A doctor did a thing like that in those days? Who would do that today? You'd call him a fool, wouldn't you? Well, if there's a heaven, Abe Hoffer is in it. That's all I can tell you. And on that note, play the Tarantella for me because I need to relax. Even the show is replayed in so many places on different days, hours. I got to be careful what I say now. What I say now at night is replayed the next day in San Francisco in the morning. People are waking up listening to this and listening to it while it's live. And the next day, and it's replayed and parlayed. Now, play a couple other pieces from The Godfather. It's very appropriate. You know, when remember that great scene in The Godfather? I'm going to go back to GF1, where Don Corleone is in the garden. Beautiful, touching scene with Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, in his last scene before he dies of a heart attack with the grandchild. It's actually a very touching scene. I watched it the other day, and I realized why it touched me so deeply. My father had died just before this movie. I remember when they were making it, and they saying it was coming out, and I said, gee, my dad would love this movie. Then he died, and he couldn't see it because it was like from his era, you know. So I watched the movie. It was very personal to me, that movie. But I remember the Godfather figure with Marlon Brando sitting in the garden talking to Michael. What? No, you don't have to play it. And he says to him, what's wrong, Michael? Michael says to him, what's wrong, Dad? And then Marlon Brando says, with an incredible, what an actor this guy was, he says, I don't know, Michael. He says, I dreamed that one day you'd be Senator Corleone, Congressman Corleone, Governor Corleone. We didn't have enough time, Michael. We didn't have enough time. And then Michael says, it's okay, Dad. We'll get there. You know, he said, okay, they're gangsters. But there was a human element in that interchange that's astounding. And I think about that with regard to the situation we're living in today. And I wonder to myself, did they finally get enough time?
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Well, I'm glad that I could be with you on The Savage Nation. This is AM radio. Never forget it. This is the big league. This is Yankee Stadium. This is Yankee Stadium of, this is the Yankee Stadium of the media. You know, make no mistake about it. This is the big, big arena. I had a dream about this last night. I'm deeply in touch with my subconscious, or shall I say my subconscious is deeply in touch with me, which is interesting unto itself. And in the dream, I remember thinking, God, that's good, but it's not AM radio. God, that's good, but he's not in AM radio. Because I realized this is the cauldron here. This is it. This is it. This is the big league. Every breath, every word, every inflection, every insight, every mistake is heard around the world. It's a business like no other. I was in the dental chair this morning. I went for minor dental work. And the dentist said to me, she said to me, how are you doing? And I told her. She said, are you still enjoying it? I said, yes. I said, but it's very difficult. She said, why? As the drill, you know. As she scraped away at Mount Rushmore of my teeth. I said, because it's a business like no other. I said, one wrong word, and you lose everything. I said, one wrong word in this business, and you lose everything. I don't think there's another business like it other than politics, where one wrong word can destroy you. Do you know that? Which is why it's very sad our political class has become leaderless. It's not that they're stupid. It's not that they're incapable of leading us, some of them. It's that the times that we live in make it almost impossible to say what you really mean unless you really are so confident in what you mean is going to, you know, be supported. You don't say anything. You talk and double talk. The politicians speak in rhymes. They say nothing. So we've lost interest in them. So who do we turn to? We turn to talk radio. That's absolutely true. Absolutely turn to talk radio for any conversation today. Doesn't mean there isn't any other conversation out there. I was on a friend's yacht the other night, Labor Day, and I met some young people, younger than me by a couple of decades. They happened to be from a South American nation. Lovely couple. Young children weren't there, and we talked. They didn't even know me. I didn't know them. I was introduced by, we just had a, you know, I had a beer. They had drank, blah, blah, blah. He cooked some meat. And we talk. So there are very intelligent people out there who talk with each other, obviously. But I'm talking about in the media. There's no other dialogue. Certainly it's not on ABC, CBS, or NBC. It's a format that doesn't lend itself to conversation. Television, they've tried the talk format in television. It doesn't work for whatever reason. I've seen it tried. Yes, Joan, you're on from Columbus, Ohio. What do you say, Joan? Blah, blah, blah. Somehow it doesn't grip me. Why does talk radio grip you? Why do millions of people rely upon talk radio for their link to reality? I ask myself, but I know the answer. I, Merlin the magician of talk radio, know the answer. Why? Because there's no props. There's no props. There's no makeup. There's no lights. There's no distractions. There's no flashes. Every minute a flash with the news on television. You can get Petite Mal watching the news. And the crossing in the legs and the lipstick in the hair. The poor girls, what they have to do to attract your attention. I don't have any of that. And even if I could, I wouldn't cross my legs and put on lipstick for your attention. I don't have to do that. So what do I have? Nothing but my brains, my heart, my knowledge, and my voice. That's all. And if you're lucky enough to be able to combine all of that and project it out into the media, through the media to the world, you're a very lucky man. But it's all a miracle. At the end of the day, it's all a miracle. I guess I believe in miracles in that regard. Mr. Pragmatist here, Michael Savage, hard-nosed savage, believes in miracles. It's all a miracle. You want to hear something amazing? If you open up the Bible, the Jewish prayer book, rather, I want to read one paragraph. Please indulge me. You want to hear something? Here is the morning prayer that a religious man is supposed to read every morning. Blessed are you, Lord, our God, King of the universe, who has formed man in his wisdom and created within him numerous orifices and cavities. It is revealed and known before the throne of your glory that if one of them were to be blocked or one of them were to be opened, it would be impossible to exist even for a short while. Blessed are you, Lord, who heals all flesh and performs wonders. Now, think about that. When was that written? Before the age of anatomy? The ancient Jews knew about arteries, and veins, that if one of them were to be blocked or one of them were to be opened, it would be impossible to exist even for a short while. So let's say you're a worrier. Let's say all day long you worry about a heart attack. Oh, God, every cringe in a car. You're 32 years old, you have two children or whatever, and every second you feel indigestion, you think you're dying. Oh, my God, what's that? Cardioneurosis, every second. What you're really doing is praying, but you don't realize it. By fearing death, you're actually reaching out to God and saying, please don't kill me. I have two young children, or I'm alone. I don't want to die here in the car. I don't want to crash into a light pole. In essence, it's very funny when you think about it, but the fear of disease and fear of death, obsessional fear of death and disease, is actually a few steps removed from worship of the worship of God. I'm the only one who's ever seen this. It was revealed to me in a dream. God told me to tell you that today. So let's say you're not only a hypochondriac of a minor order, but a major hypochondriac. What you're really doing is sublimating your wish to pray to God to keep you alive another second. And so it would be simpler if actually you stopped being a hypochondriac and you actually prayed to God six times a day and said these prayers in whatever language or whatever means you meant to. You just say, God, you know, we have all these vessels and these this and these that. And you know what? I'm enjoying my life. I'm not a bad guy. Or say to yourself what I learned to say the other day. I saw it in a Chinese fortune cookie. Do you know that I learned from a Chinese fortune cookie if it's good? Do you know that I can learn from a Chinese fortune cookie? I must have read them for 30 years and thrown them out. They're silly. I saw one the other day that I swear to God saved me. You know what it said? It saved me temporarily. It said, your virtues outweigh, your virtues outweigh your faults. That's what it said. Your virtues outweigh your faults. You know, when I get down on myself, I immediately go into that statement. When I say, oh, I did this, I did that, how come I didn't do this? Why didn't I do more push-ups? Why didn't I was nicer to this one? Why did I lose my temper? You know what that is. That's the road to perdition when you're starting with that one. Don't beat yourself up. Say your virtues outweigh your faults. We all have faults. But are your virtues more than your faults? Good. That's it. So a human being. So that's why I'm giving you this religious stuff today, because I want to. How do you feel about it, though? That's what I'm asking you. You like it or you don't like it? You want me to stop it never again? You want me to do it more? You want me to do it less? I mean, look, America has a hardcore religious base. You take a highway that runs from the east coast of Florida, and it goes all the way through the southern states. I have a friend in the media who says to me, why? He said, I listen to you on Highway 40. He said, I get you from one state to the next, all through the night, all through the day. He likes to drive in a car alone. He collects his thoughts or whatever. He said, you're on Highway 40. I pick you up Louisiana, then I get you in Texas. Then I get you in the panhandle, and then I get you in New Mexico. Then I get you in Arizona. He said, you got to stay on the air. He said, Michael, you're the voice of America. Actually, the funniest thing is President Bill Clinton trying a vegetarian diet. You hear this? That'd be like Bill Clinton trying celibacy. Here's President Bill Clinton saying he's trying a vegetarian diet to stay healthy. Listen.
Have you looked that far down the road to grandchildren and the blessings of grandchildren in your life?
Yeah, I'm trying to stay healthy enough to have them. That's what I want to do.
Well, you look quite fit. How are you? And as I understand it, Chelsea asked you to slim down a little bit before you walked her down the aisle. But with your travel to Haiti, with CGI coming up, with being on the campaign trail, have you been able to manage to keep those eating habits healthy?
My travel schedule is cut back on my exercise some, which is frustrating to me, but I follow a pretty strict diet, and I try to, you know, limit how much I eat and what I eat, and I lost 20 pounds or so.
Vegan or vegetarian?
Listen to the rest of this puff piece garbage from Yahoo. May as well be the government press. Yahoo and the Huffington Post may as well be the government press. Listen to the next puff piece to Clinton.
Vegan or vegetarian or?
Yeah, pretty much. Once in a while I'll eat fish, but not often, because I'm trying to be one of those experimenters. Since 1986, several hundred people who have tried essentially a plant-based diet, not ingesting any cholesterol from any source, have seen their bodies start to heal themselves.
Oh, please. I wrote the book on this in 1972. Mr. Clinton, we may not agree politically, but trust me, I know more about this than the idiot who's advising you. And there's a lot less to it than meets the eye. So don't knock yourself out. I'm not telling you to go back to cheeseburgers and Monica Lewinsky types. And when I was talking about submitted files, I was not discussing Bill Clinton. I want to be clear about that. I mean, yes, there is a malady primarily suffered by Anglo-Nordic males who are fixated on biblical Semitic type, like Monica Lewinsky. I was not referring to Bill Clinton. I admit that. But the fact is, stop with the vegan or vegetarian, because whether or not you want to accept it, Mr. Clinton, I wrote the book on nutrition when many of these people didn't even know what the word was, and they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Let me give you an example. Since I'm going to get into this, and I'll do it in about 2 minutes or less, Mr. Clinton and all the others listening. This stuff was promoted back in the 70s, that if you went on a diet with no cholesterol and primarily plants, you could reverse the arterial occlusion and you could be a new man. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't give up the cholesterol-laden foods, but cholesterol isn't the issue. It's the saturated fat that's the issue, number one, and whether or not the saturated fat that you're taking in is oxidizing inside your arteries and causing the occlusion. And that is prevented by taking large enough doses of vitamin C, vitamin A, and other antioxidants, which is something that these quacks should know about after 30 years, but they still don't admit the value of supernutrients. But let me go to the next step, Mr. Clinton and others listening to me. You're experimenting with these vegan diets as though it's something brand new. This was promoted by a health food quack in Sausalito in the 1970s. It was also heavily promoted by the Pritikin diet. The fact of the matter is, let me show you a study. Let me introduce you to another study that they don't want you to know about. I'll never forget it. As I was working for my PhD in human nutrition at the great University of California at Berkeley, which I earned in 1978, by the way, in less than 3 years, probably a world record. I don't think anybody else ever earned a PhD in a shorter time from such a great university. I learned the following. There was a study done out of India on 17,000 railway workers. Now, the reason I mention the number, Mr. Clinton, is because you have to have a large enough sample to draw a conclusion that has any validity whatsoever. You can't prove very much with a small population that's being studied. 10 people, 15 people means very little. 17,000 railway workers is a big sample. Why does it matter whether they were railway workers? Because they were largely involved in the same job category. Some were handlers, baggage handlers, some were ticket takers, whatever. But by and large, they were in the same profession, so they were subjected in the overall scheme of things to the same stresses from the job. They divided the group up into two groups. One half of the group were vegetarian, and the other half was not vegetarian. And take a guess what they discovered. The vegetarian group had a much higher rate of heart attacks than the non-vegetarian group. Now, this is something that's not known, but I'm an expert in the field, Mr. Clinton. I'm not saying go back to your cheeseburgers. Go and eat the fish, for God's sakes. Eat a low-fat diet. Take high doses of vitamin C and vitamin E. I guarantee you'll live a lot longer than going pure vegetarian, which is liable to kill you altogether, God forbid. And I'm telling you that for a reason. They have to ask, well, why would the vegetarians in India have had higher rates of heart attack, higher incidence of heart attack, to use a specific term, than the non-vegetarians? Remember, the non-vegetarians in India were eating things like ghee, which is clarified butter. You understand that? I mean, they were eating high-fat diets, and they had lower incidence of heart attacks than the vegetarians. The answer is quite simple, and I'll tell it to you at another time. I got to take this from another angle for you. I'm playing the spacey music for a reason. I'm driving in the car up and down in the mountains with my friend, who's a physicist, Dr. Sarfati, Jack Sarfati. You say physicist, you think like a distinguished professor. He's better than a distinguished professor. He's my friend. But he's a very, very intelligent, interesting guy. We talk a lot about a lot of things. And he was astonished at my ability to see things before they happen. And he loves my book. He loves me. We know each other for many years. And something happened in the car that was astonishing, which I'm not going to divulge. It's a personal thing, because he got home and emailed me. He said, just what you mentioned about a long-lost family member who I haven't heard from in years. We were talking about an uncle of his who was a hero in World War II, who a guy from Brooklyn, Listen to this story. I got to tell you the whole story. His uncle was a guy from Brooklyn. And he was like a dancer who was about to go to Hollywood. He was offered a role in Hollywood. But his father said to him, this is just before World War II, go into the reserve so you can get it over with and then go to Hollywood to pick up your movie career. He goes into the reserves. He has a week to go. The Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. He's one of the first boats sent over to the Pacific Islands. And he had been harassed to death by the Marine Corps. Army. And they picked on him because he was Jewish. They made him do the worst work, peeling potatoes, cleaning latrines. But he never gave in. He didn't cry and whine and go to the – he did it, whatever they said. They made him dig ditches when the other guys would laugh at him. As a result, he was in the first wave of one of the actions on one of the beaches where 90% of the men were killed. And he said he survived primarily because the sergeants were so mean to him and he was in such great physical shape because of the digging and the hard work. He was lean and mean and really tough. Now, that was just the beginning of the conversation. He then became the most popular man on patrols in the jungles of the South Pacific, his uncle, because he had almost a fifth sense, or a sixth sense, rather, where he could detect the Japanese sniper in the trees before anybody else. Now, remember, this is a guy from Brooklyn, this guy, his uncle. And he's now walking with some of these tough hunters, these kids who have been hunting in Georgia. They were good guys, very tough guys. But they used this kid from Brooklyn as the lead because he can see and hear things that they couldn't see and hear. He knew where the snipers were. Nobody knew how he could do it. He was able to conceive of things that they couldn't, or see and hear things. And eventually wound up working with the American Indian code talkers because he was on their wavelength in terms of ability to scout and whatnot. So anyway, the guy survives World War II. He's injured, isn't that? So I'm in the car with him and I bring it up. My friend gets home and he sends me an email. He says, you brought up something about it. And we got an email from a relative. How did you know this? Why did you bring it up? Why did you bring this up? In the same car ride, out of nowhere, I bring up Ira Einhorn and his murder of his girlfriend in Philadelphia decades ago. Out of nowhere, I brought it up and start talking about it. Jack said, I knew him, this and that. And little we know, we get home and we read the first published interview from Philadelphia with Ira Einhorn, the murderer, the man who killed his girlfriend and put her into a trunk, Holly Maddox, I remembered her name. He said, how did you come up with these things? I said, sometimes my mind goes into a wavelength where I can predict the future, and I don't know how it happens. These are on a minor scale. I mean, this is not something that you write home about what I'm telling you. I'm giving you minor examples. So I said to Jack, I said, who are the leading scientists on the precognitive reality issue, meaning people who can't, you know, okay, let's put it in common terms, premonitions. You ever have a premonition and it comes true? We all do. But there are some people who can do it on a regular basis. So I said, in the world of physics, physical sciences, who are the best minds in the area of precognitive reality? Well, he said there are several, and he gives me a list, and he says he's the leading living theoretician in that field. And I can believe that, and his new book will be out in a while, and we'll have him on for that. But Discover Magazine recently wrote an article called Back from the Future, in which a series of experiments show that measurements performed in the future can influence the present. And they ask, does that mean the universe has a destiny? And and they talk about it from that way, back to the future and the real rules of time travelers. Does the universe have a destiny? It's all about back from the future. You follow what I'm saying to you? Am I making any sense? I said to my friend Jack, I said, in terms of politics, in terms of international politics in particular, I have never been wrong. I have always been able to not so much predict what would happen as so much as deduct what would happen. And that is because I have a classically trained education in the hard sciences. I was also trained by one of the finest Aristotelian minds of our time, who no one ever heard of, called my father.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Now, here's a segment from March of 2010. There's an article out of Connecticut. Is wealth changing Connecticut politics? The running of the rich. And the newspapers are trying to show that the Republican has a bigger boat than the Democrat. The Democrat has a 28-foot power boat, and the Republican guy has a 47-foot boat called Sexy B. It's a sports yacht that they dock in Boca Raton, Florida. Does that mean that the man is a bad man because he has a 47-foot boat, and the guy with the 28-foot boat is a better man? So that means that a man without a boat is better than a man with a smaller boat, and small is good? So it leads me to the new America that we're living in. For many years, if you have it, flaunt it was the norm. For many years, ostentatiousness was the norm. For many years, wealth was the goal. And now apparently America has entered a new phase, frugality, humility, etc. But it's all a lie. It's all a fraud because, as you well know, just because you own something grand doesn't mean you stole it. And just because you don't show anything doesn't mean you're not a crook. It was well known in New York for many years that some of the biggest crooks in the city never showed their wealth. They never displayed their wealth. They hid their wealth. Some of them, I heard, wallpapered their money to their walls in Bayside, Queens. They never showed their money. How many gangster movies have you gone to where the guy said, schmuck, don't buy a new Cadillac after you knocked off the Lufthansa thing, and he killed him because they were showing the wealth with the furs and the diamonds and the blah, blah, blah. So to me, what the hell is the difference if the guy has a bigger yacht? It's a matter of whether he's honest or not. Then they say that, naturally, it's a left-wing article. It's because the Republicans always have bigger boats than the Democrats, therefore they're no good. And they say both boats are swamped in the wake from Odalisque. Republican Tom Foley's 100-foot ship flagged under the Republic of Marshall Islands and hailing from the port of Bikini. Big deal. He didn't steal it from anybody. Or then they show that a lieutenant governor's wife has a Maserati Quattroporte, while the Republican has a 1993 Chevy pickup truck. What does this really mean? Does being rich mean that you're unqualified to understand what the average person is going through? And so what's interesting is Hearst, Connecticut newspapers gave 11 of the gubernatorial and U.S. Senate candidates a questionnaire. And they wanted to get insights into how they use their wealth. They want to know what cars they drive, how much they give to charity, where they vacation, what they spend on a haircut, what they spend on business attire, or where they like to go out and eat. Would you like to have the same questionnaire given to those in the news business? How'd you like that? I mean, what, you know, I looked at this and I said to myself, wait a minute, what does this have to do with anything? I started out with nothing and I have something now. I'm not a rich man, but I have something. So, I mean, what car do I drive? Let me give you an example. I went and started up my 65 Cadillac. I haven't driven it for over 6 months. It sits in a garage in a house I have, like a barn up on a hill, and it's got a trickle charger on it at all time. I turn it over, it starts like the Woody Allen Volkswagen in a movie from the 1960s. The engine cranked over, this big 7-liter monster. Baroom. It stinks, I can't stand the smell, but the car rides like a baby carriage. Now, is that the car I drive every day, a 65 Caddy? No, I didn't drive it in 7 months. I drive a new Mercedes S600, the best car I've ever owned. Should I be ashamed of my Mercedes? Why should I be ashamed of it? I didn't take it from you. What kind of boat do I have? Well, I could tell you I have a 22-foot boat, and you'd say, well, that's modest. I might want one, too. Then I could tell you I have a 63-foot yacht that I drive myself, too. Did I take it from you? No, I didn't take it from you. I earned it. It's my hobby. That's your business, too? I live in the United States of America. I'm not allowed to have what I earned, or have to give it to you because you can't earn anything. I mean, these are very important questions, but I'm all over the map when you look at it. Okay, where do they vacation? Answer, nowhere. I hate travel. So what does that make me? Oh, now you're one of us because you don't vacation. Number two, how much do you spend on a haircut? Nothing. I don't get them. I usually look in the mirror like a convict with a scissor and cut the back of my head because I can't stand barbershops. I don't like the breath of the barber. I don't like the people in a barbershop. I can't get anyone to come to my house to cut my hair. I do it with a mirror and a scissor just as well. Number four. How much do you spend on business attire? Answer, none. I never wear a suit and tie. And if I do, you're not going to believe this one. In a million years, you won't believe it. From the period of my life prior to being on radio, which goes back over 16 years this March 20th, I had business suits from my previous life as a corporate consultant and a lecturer. You know what I did? I swear to God, 3 months ago, I was going to throw the suits out. I took them to a tailor and had them refit. Why? It's in my blood not to throw away good material. I told you when I was a kid, my father would make me wear dead man's pants because he didn't buy me new clothes. He bought it from the dead man. It's a famous story from Psychological Nudity. They cut him off at the knee and blah, 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 and I had to wear dead man's pants. But he taught me the value of a good piece of fabric. So when I was going to throw out a Hot Shaft Remarks suit, I said, how can I do this? It was against my will. I had it refit. Am I wearing it? No, I still don't wear it. But I know now, if I should die, I have a suit ready for me. So I don't spend anything on business clothing. Next question. Where do they like to go out and eat? Answer. I like takeout food. I prefer from a cheap Chinese and Japanese restaurant in my neighborhood. Under $10 a meal is my preference. Do I go to other restaurants? Yes, you've heard me talk about them. When I'm in the mood. But generally, I like to eat at home watching television. I'm in the media. I like to watch the news, or I like to watch the Science Channel or Military History or Discovery so that I can learn something. I can't waste the spare minute, in other words, sitting in a restaurant. I can't take listening to other people. So I'm all over the map. I have a big boat and I have a small boat. I have an old car. I have a new car. I have old clothes and no new clothes. I cut my own hair and I go out to eat in a lunchbox in my kitchen. So what does that make me? It makes me me. So what in the world is the point of this story? No one's calling on this. It's amazing. You try something original and the lights don't go on. So I will go to something basic now. Already it's too hard. You didn't hear about this on Fat Boy Show in the morning, so you can't talk about it. Here we go. Now, let's go back to what I'm talking about. Wealth. Does wealth necessitate evil? Does poverty necessitate goodness? I read a book when I was a young man trying to figure things out entitled The Superior Virtue of the Oppressed, written by the great Bertrand Russell. And it caught me off guard. What do you mean, the superior virtue of the oppressed? Well, he was being sarcastic. He was arguing, even though he was a socialist, he was a brilliant, brilliant mathematician and philosopher in some ways. Bertrand Russell was arguing that just because you're oppressed doesn't mean you have superior virtue. And just because you may be wealthy doesn't mean you have inferior virtue. Do you get understanding what I'm saying? But now we're living through a new ethos in America where wealth is automatically assumed to have been gotten illicitly or illegally. And in some cases, it is true. Just look at the Democrat Party. It's rife with the illegitimate. But it doesn't mean it's 100% true. So there it goes. What, a bigger boat means you're a bad guy, and no boat means you're a good guy. So by that definition, the beggar is the superior man. By that definition, the homeless person is the saint, and anyone who has a decent life and house is a bum. I don't buy it. Don't call me on it. Means nothing. 1-800-449-8255. If you earned it, spend it. It's your business. It's not the government's business to tell you how to spend your money. New York City, W.R. Jr. on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Well, you were talking before, Michael, about being poor, people saying that if you own a boat, you're rich. And
right.
That is so untrue. My husband and I, we started out renting a boat where you went out to the fishing station and they towed you out and put you in a place called Rowboat Alley. And when you wanted to come in, you put your oar up and they pulled you back
right.
In. And then,
well, yeah, nobody would argue with you being rich when you're in a boat like that. But what if you have a 50-foot power boat? Should you be denied the right to vote in America because suddenly the poverty is suddenly considered a virtue?
Oh, no, but what I'm just saying, that's how we started. And then we got we escalated up into a 24-foot cabin cruiser where people said, oh, you're so rich. But what they didn't know is I shopped in bargain basements. I went to rummage sales. I went to the Jewish bazaars and bought the dry.
Yeah, but it's your business what you buy with your money. You didn't steal it from anybody. Who is the government to tell you that you shouldn't spend it any way you want? Where is it written that you not buy a boat, not buy a car? What kind of society are we living in? Everyone should wear a blue uniform with a red star on it?
That's my point. People saying that you're rich because you have a boat? No, because you work hard for it? Why?
Well, what if you have a 160-foot boat, though? I mean, so what? Does that disqualify a man from running for office? Why should it?
But you work for it. Why? You're entitled to it.
No, it doesn't matter what my point was, is that poverty is not a virtue, and wealth is not necessarily a vice, you know? That's my point. Thanks for the call. Judge the person by how they got the money, not what they're spending it on. To a certain point, yes, how they spend it. Sure, you want to build ice sculptures with it for your son's bris is another story. You can say the guy's crazy.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of March of 2010 from the Savage Nation. You know, I like the filibuster technique in Congress. They have it for a reason. But I don't like to be filibustered by a dentist with halitosis, which is why I don't get haircuts. I was trying to tell you that earlier. Then I thought about something else. Remember a few weeks ago I amused on the show, why does nature do this to middle-aged men? Why do they reduce the hair on our heads and increase the hair on our backs, ears, and nose? I couldn't understand it. And then it dawned on me that the reason we start to lose our hair in middle age is so we can avoid the barber. It's actually a blessing. That's the whole reason that it gives you baldness in middle age. Because nose hair you can cut yourself. Ear hair you can cut yourself. I once had a turbo groomer put out my, when I was a local host, they gave me one. I forget, are they still in business, the sharper image? I don't even know. I think they went out, right? I can say something about them. I think they went out. Sharper image. Any day I had a nose groomer. I still have the thing. And you turn it on, and it has a little thing that spins around like a weed cutter, a little weed cutter for your nose. Very nice. You put it in your ear. I started to think about it. If you put like a little weed cutter in your ear, and it spins around with those little invisible blades, and the little tiny hairs fall down your ear canal. That can't be good for your hearing. Likewise in your nose, why would God want you to trim, or nature, let's say you don't believe in, why would nature want you to trim the hairs in your nose? It's meant to keep flies out. So I can think back into the ancient times, like you lived, let's say, your great-grand, whatever. They lived in Syria, where the meat spoiled because there was no refrigeration, no preservatives, and there were flies on the meat in the butcher stall. In other words, if you go to the Middle East today, it's the same thing as it was 500 years ago. But getting back to the nose hair, in other words, if you live in a place where there's a lot of flies around the meat because there's no preservatives, then you understand why nature permits the middle-aged man to have more nose hair and more ear hair. It's to keep the critters out from going in your ear or nose. So you say, well, why don't young people have that? Well, it's a flaw in the original intelligent design. Perhaps there will come a time that young children will evolve to the point where they also have the equivalent of Uncle Mo's nose and ear hair, and they too will be free of the plague of meat flies. Okay, I warned the guys this would happen today. Remember today as another day like yesterday, which is everyone's a winner. Anyone who makes it past Doug the screener and gets on the show with something interesting to say, we'll get a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty. San Francisco, Kelly, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, I cannot believe I'm actually talking to you. Oh, I have to say two things. First of all, you're an extended part of the family. My dad passed away, God rest his soul, almost 20 years ago. But I'm telling you, you sitting in the front seat, the passenger seat of your dad's truck, you guys driving on the way into work, you're given the recipes of what your mom's making. I can taste, I can smell, I can do all this stuff when I listen to you. And
now, Kelly, are you a native San Franciscan?
Well, I hate to say it, I'm a native Californian, and I want out of this state so bad.
I can make a few remarks about native San Franciscans. I won't do it. What's the primary point of your call other than to say you love me?
I worship you. No, my 17-year-old son, I'm not married, my 17-year-old son, he enjoys you. At work, it's the hush-hush. Hey, did you listen to Michael Savage today?
I'm the missing family man. I'm the man who used to be in every household. I'm the man who says it like it is. I'm the guy in the house that was thrown out by radical feminism. I'm the guy in the house who ran away from the striking wife. I'm the guy in the house who's raising your son. Am I right or wrong?
You're right.
Mariola in New York on WR. Mariola, go ahead, please.
Hello, Dr. Savage. I was calling to commend you on your frugality, and I think that your father and my father, who came to this country from Poland in 1964, they're kindred spirits. They really are. And as a child, you know, we just did what we were told. I'm the eldest of six children. I have a sister who's 14 years younger than me. And, you know, kids...
Well, we may have done what we were told until we became teenagers, and I didn't do what I was told at that point. I don't know about you.
Oh, my friends were swimming in their pools, and we were harvesting vegetables and fruit.
Oh, okay. Well, that's right. Even in the neighborhood I lived in, I was the only kid who worked on Saturday in my father's store. I hated it. Don't think I liked it. He said you have to work in order to get tougher, in order to know what a dollar is worth. I didn't want to go in. I wanted to stay home and goof around with my friends, but I couldn't. He wouldn't let me.
My father is retired in Vermont now, Dr. Savage, and you think...
Oh, I'm sorry to hear it. He's around Red Robin territory, huh?
Oh, my gosh, please. You don't have to remind... It's awful, but honestly, the man is living off the land now, and why? He said it... it reminds him of Poland, you know, the terrain, and he says...
Well, he knew how to grow things. You know what a rare thing that is, to know how to grow a vegetable? Let me tell you, as a city guy myself, who has a couple of suburban properties... My biggest thrill is to grow fruit trees and tomatoes. It's still a miracle to me.
Ground that did not bear fruit. He just, forget about landscaping. If it did not bear
fruit. Right. I know that many European immigrants of my generation would not waste even a lawn. They grew, even in Queens, some of them in their backyard, they grew vegetables. They thought it was a waste of land to grow grass, as strange as that sounds.
We had rhubarb. We had cucumbers, carrots, tomatoes. I mean, we used to go in between the tomatoes and have to kill the little...
Well, then Michelle Obama should give you an award.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Anyway, so I'm going to continue now. Most of the people are calling saying continue the story. It's only of two more pages. The Clown, 1973, and it's about Josco the Clown, and he has an Algerian friend warming him up. And the Algerian talks about his life in a Parisian monastery where he wasn't able to talk, and Josco is getting ready to go on stage. Well, he broke off. He was sitting in front of a mirror. And in front of the mirror, as he's putting on his makeup, his clown makeup, he remembers his mental breakdown. And he's thinking back on it. And he remembers the doctor saying to him to stay focused and to not go back and back over what happened to him. So we go back again. Still, he could not quickly jump from the image of the small blonde-haired boy screaming as he was pushed over the railing. Insanity and the best West Coast lawyer gave him legal freedom. But even expensive psychiatrists were unable to free this man of his own conscience. In the long months in the mountains after the usual cycle of hysteria, followed by catatonia, the cycle repeated several times a day at first, but gradually diminishing in frequency until the man was able to have enough time between cycles to experience the performance of his own life activities, he had done much reading. He had always been interested in the life activities of so-called primitive peoples. But now he pathologically only read about such things as related to murder, cannibalism, patricide, genocide, and of course infanticide. Of course he had had inklings before that day. Once on an overnight hike with his little family, the Nukes as he referred to his little family, the Nukes, he had had a strong negative current overcome him. They were all camped out for the night on a ledge 30 feet above a crystalline stream dammed up as a fish pond, when he felt the nearly overwhelming desire to throw his child to the waters below. Getting a hold of himself, as most sane men do when they feel such primitive urges, the man quickly awakened his wife and child, and startling them into their clothing, he insisted they make the 6 miles back right then in the moonlight and lantern, which they did. But then the night on the bridge, his wife's subsequent suicide, and his years in the mountains were mere memories now. Through the monitor, Josco heard the Algerian's last lines and lifted himself for the performance. That's the end of The Clown. Now, there's one little note at the end of the story about what the stage set should look like. I don't know whether this was a short story or whatever, but the theater is, quote, shabby but elegant, velvet with gold ropes, a proscenium, boxes in a poor section of town. The stage, when the Algerian performs, a sign on the stage right says, "No responding, please." Throughout his performance, no audience response, except for an occasional cough, the sounds of traffic outside, or better still, impossible rock music penetrating from a neighborhood bar. When Josko performs, though, great response is required. He lives for these sounds. Opening night, 30 people, his comeback, a poor response. But in fades back to his earlier successes, Full House's Roaring. I guess there's another page I'm not going to bore you with, but it's the Victorian Mansion House and what it actually looks like for the movie version of Josko the Clown. All right, 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. So I took a chance. I walked on a tightrope with you today on the Savage Nation. It's something that was left me with cold hands, as though I was just beginning in radio. It's a very tough thing to do, but you know, after 16 years in radio, mainly doing politics 95% of the time, I have to tell you that I myself need to rejuvenate myself, and I need to open up some other parts of myself that have never been really, I don't know what to use the word, exposed or whatever on the Savage Nation. And one of them is some of the writings, for better or for worse. The other part is the nutrition side. I'm going to do a segment or two a week taking your calls on nutritional questions. I'm going to talk about my years as a social worker and what I observed actually being a social worker, as opposed to what the phony socialists tell you social workers do. I'll tell you what I saw working with the so-called poor and how they were scamming the system. I'm going to do a lot of things I've not done on the show because it's time for a change. And the thing is this, you have all day long listened to talk radio. If you're a fanatic talk radio listener, you've probably been listening on and off since the morning. And I know that you know what the news is. Yeah, if there's a breaking story, you're going to get it from me. There is no breaking story right now. It's the news of the week. I could have reviewed it and just done rock and roll. I can do that. And you know what to expect, and you'll be comfortable. But I don't want you to be comfortable. I don't want to be too comfortable. I want to take chances. I want to walk on a tightrope. 1-800-449-8255. Mark in New York, go ahead, please. What do you think? Should I read these stories or not?
Absolutely. I'll tell you, Mike, you brought me out of a funk that I've been in for years. I've been studying this communist for 4 years, and I can't get my mind off anything else. Your story was very inspiring.
Well, he is a communist. He is trying to destroy America. He's as dangerous as they come. If we don't stop this man by throwing the Democrats out in October, in November, then throwing him out in 2012, we've lost the country. Now, that doesn't mean the Republicans are going to do much different. They're going to take us down the same road, only on a little slower pace. But the fact of the matter is the man has to be stopped, because there is no question in my mind he and Michelle are absolute Marxists. I've seen this from day one. A year before he was elected, I was telling people what he was, and I'm glad that others in the media finally caught on to what a Marxist is. But I agree with your obsession. That's why I'm reading the stories. There's only so much I could do on that story, on that other issue.
Mike, I'm a musician. I haven't been able to play music for 2 years because I can't get my mind off this disaster, this imminent disaster.
This charlatan, how in the world do he and Michelle get away with it? The girl goes on a vacation in Spain that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. She lectures us on healthy living, and every time I see her, she's slurping an ice cream cone with her children. Do they not understand that people understand that she's a liar and a fraud? And the biggest joke is Vanity Fair nominates her as one of the best-dressed women on Earth. Do they think we're that blind?
Embarrassment. They both are.
But I'm saying something else. The popular culture, are they that stupid that they buy into this?
They are.
When I went to, I was in Mallorca in 66, I think, when it was just emerging from a sleepy artist colony in a way. So they were really building small condos. And I, you know, talk about literary. You want to see connection. I went there for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons I went there is because the poets were there. I remember on my Dia de Mallorca was the Robert Graves, the poet, big deal. No one ever heard of him anymore. Robert Graves walked around with a black cape up in the hills, coming down with the cobblestone, and all the girls and the boys would run after him like he was God. God only knows if anyone remembers who he is. But on the dopey island of Mallorca where I stayed, there was a poet, a couple of good writers. There was Alan Sillitoe, who had a big hit at the time called, he had written Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. Didn't he write Rosemary's Baby? I don't remember, but he wrote Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. British, you know, laborer class, I hate the word working class. Everyone works. I'm working class. I'm working right now. What does working class mean? I love when they say, born to a working class family. Who the hell is the writer? What was he born to? Royalty? I mean, working class. Everyone in America works except those who work for the government or vote for Obama. They don't work. They live on my work. But Alan Sillitoe was a factory worker. Let's make it clear. And he wrote a great book about what it was like to be an English factory worker in the 50s. It became a big movie. I loved that. So I remember meeting him in Mallorca. Here I was, I don't know, a kid. I couldn't have been, I don't want to tell you my age because you know it anyway from every source on the earth. I was young, so I go there, I meet these writers, hang out, you know, to drink like them. Big deal. They were all drunks in those days. In those days, a writer had to be a drunk. I don't know where that came from. Nobody can write when they're drunk. They couldn't write then when they were drunk, and they can't write now when they're drunk. I have no idea where that came from. You had to be a drug addict or an alcoholic to be a writer. The exact opposite is true. I remember Huxley wrote that how did he put it? It was so beautifully written. Is that we perform or we write despite our weaknesses, not because of them. Despite them. In other words, despite being a drunk, you write. I don't understand it, but he would drink himself. He'd go to this bar. I remember to this day the name of the bar. To this day in Palma, it was called Bar Africa. So here I am, this young kid, you know, and I made some friends with the guys there. You know, they were writers, hangers-on, would-be writers, expat, you know, basically bums. And Alan Sillitoe would drink and fall down drunk, fall asleep on a bench. And his lovely wife, Rosemary, would sit there with the baby. They had a young baby. She was like Madonna and child. And she would, like, take him home, you know, in the car. I thought that was so romantic. Wasn't romantic, but when you're young, you have these distorted views of what romance is. It was a tragedy. The kid had a drunk for a father. And then I met a wonderful poet, Riven Todd, probably long dead. He was a nature poet. I loved him. A Garland for a Winter Solstice. Beautiful poem. What'd you just write? Sillitoe just died this year. You just said, huh. Is Riven Todd still alive? He did write The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. I knew it. Yeah. And then there was Riven Todd. So from those years, I started writing, you know, the drivel. You start with the drivel. You start with the little thoughts and the this. And as you develop, you write longer pieces and longer pieces and longer. And then eventually, if you're smart enough and lucky enough, you become a talk show host. And then you find your archives 40 years later. And then you read one of them on the air and you're still living. And you say, ah, is this not happiness? That's what it is, ladies and gentlemen. You know, and without you, I'm sorry to sound corny, without the audience, there'd be nothing. But I always knew there'd be an audience. You see, this is what I'm trying to tell you. I always had faith. I always knew there'd be an audience for me. I always had faith in myself, and so I didn't throw my stories away. Savage. So, California's interesting. Northern California has its own little weather system, much different than the East Coast. Being an East Coaster, it's kind of unusual to me to have the second summer. This is our real summer. So out here, we get the real summer now. You know, it's not cold, not windy. And then we have our own, like, set of holidays. Like, this weekend was the Blue Angels Navy weekend. You know, the city goes wild for it, except for the old commie scum. Who complain, why do they fly over our city, disturbing my reading of Leaves of Grass? I was laying in bed reading the beatnik literature of my youth, and I heard the roar of airplanes. It disturbed me as it shook my window panes and pained my lungs. But everyone likes it, except the newspapers. You know, they put it down. But the people love it. So hundreds of thousands of people, you go into the city to watch the Blue Angels. And everyone who has a boat is out on the bay. They're watching the air show Thursday and a Friday and a Saturday, Sunday. Then the Columbus Day thing was Sunday. But since I wasn't invited to a certain restaurant that I used to go to, I won't mention it ever again and not go there ever again either. The only one I'll mention is the one I mentioned already. So I went out alone to watch the parade of ships on my boat. 40 tons, you know. I would fill 40 tons of yacht on my own, took it out. Nobody, zero, no, not even the dog. I was in one of those moods after last week, which I called Hell Week. I wanted to be alone. I didn't even want to hear a dog bark. I didn't even want the distraction of a dog barking. So I took the boat out alone. And it's not so heroic. It's only on the bay, and it's got a bow and stern thruster. So I go out, watch the parade of ships. It was kind of boring, to be frank. The big warships weren't there. There's one, like, you know, 800-foot, like, a marine amphibious land. Not that interesting. It's not like watching the Big Mo. I mean, I've seen the Big Mo at dock when it was out here, the Missouri. It's unbelievable. Or a real modern aircraft carrier, the Nimitz I was on. You say, holy God. I mean, I was honored to be aboard the Nimitz a few years ago. I don't think they'd ever have me again. The word is probably out on banned on aircraft carriers, as well as banned in Britain. But when I watch those young men in their flying machines taking off on night missions, training missions, it's like watching a rocket take off the deck. It was 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, black ocean, black sky, and all of a sudden, all you see is the afterburners on the FA-18 Hornets, and you see rockets taking off on a deck, and you just sit there shaking and shuddering with the genius of man. The only thing you pray is that we had something other than a panty waist running the military, and they could just end the war already by killing the enemy in his stronghold. Wipe him off the planet already. Use some of the weapons that we paid for instead of milking us dry for more weapons that you're not going to use is all you pray when you watch the jets take off, which is why I wasn't invited back. So to make a long story short, so it's that weekend. So I go out alone. I watch the parade of ships. The first couple of ships, there were more Coast Guard ships and Navy patrol vessels and police boats and old menopausal men whose boats were converted into like patrol boats than there were observers, because they were afraid of being boarded by these schmucks with 40 caliber Glocks. Everyone was on patrol. I was afraid to even get near the ships. I never saw such a cordon like this. I didn't even dare get near. I mean, I didn't want them to come aboard. They're a pain in the neck. They once boarded my ship. I'm not very impressed with the Coast Guard, to be honest with you. I know you're supposed to glorify everyone in the uniform, but at the end of the day, you know, not everyone in the uniform is special. Some people are just idiots in uniforms with guns and clubs, and some are wonderful. I get the idiots. Not this weekend. Anyway, I go back. So, anyway, the dog isn't even here. I don't want to be with him because of this morning with the rug with the foot. I had to give him to the cleaner, and that's it. I'd like to have sent my foot out to a Martin, you know, Martinizing. I wanted to have my foot Martinized after this morning. Whoa, that's a bad experience. I mean, I raise children, but that happens like once in a child rearing. That middle of the night, early morning squish, great for the sex life between husband and wife. I got to tell you, young children are the greatest thing to keep a sex life alive. Between the plastic rattles, the regurgitation, and the doo-doo, and eating in restaurants with the diet. Oh, wonderful thing for romance. I think that's how God sets it up that way. I don't know how. I don't understand. It's like hair on a man as he gets older. It grows in the wrong places. There's something to do with that. Sometimes I think God is a comedian, and he gets bored. And he needs a little fun, so he does these things to us. So it was a long Saturday. I didn't want to go out again when the real flying was boring as heck. And the heat wave hit us now. We get these this kind of week. Horrible. Horrible, like a Florida without humidity. I don't like it. I can't wait for the cold, which is coming back this weekend. I may go up to Tahoe. It's like 30 degrees up there already. I used to love autumn in Tahoe. I don't go anymore. I didn't want to go this weekend. I'm just thinking out loud. I'm letting go of tension. It's after Hell Week. Forgive me for being, you know what I'm saying? I'm letting go. I'm going to get back to trickle-up poverty. I'll talk. But I'm letting go. I'm letting it out. I'm feeling relieved. All right, so it's a long, horrible day. It's worse than watching paint dry. It's like studying nuclear physics when you're a child and you don't really understand it. It's like memorizing a new language. The day went on from 6 in the morning. It was like forever. So to make a long story short, there's a guy that we know through family, younger guy, who has a large yacht, and he's a party animal, maybe a 70-foot boat. So he emails us, he likes me, you know, why don't you come on the boat, we're going to have drinks after the end of the day, blah, blah, blah. All right, whatever, figure the end of the day is like an eternity away anyway. And he's got like beautiful, I mean, he said, well, we're dressing up in the Navy, and the girls are wearing Navy little sailorette outfits just for me. I needed to go see that. I needed more torture. You come aboard, the girls are wearing sailorette outfits, just what I wanted, more torment. So I wasn't sure I was going to go. All right, so the day is ending now. It's like long day's journey in tonight. I mean, where was Eugene O'Neill now that I needed him? It was like long day's journey in tonight. Finally, man. I said, how did you get through life without being a junkie? How did you avoid that pitfall with your nature? I mean, you're made of iron, man. I had to congratulate myself. I didn't even have a drink. Nothing. If I was another person, it would have been like mainline city if I was a weak person. Those are the kind of days, I mean, you say, holy God, how many hours are there in a day? You know, thanks for blessing me with so much freedom and so much health. Now what? I don't know what to do with myself. So the night falls, and I start emailing and getting emails. Well, we're lost. We can't get back in the harbor because it's an unmarked channel. I live near an unmarked channel. And the guy had a new captain. So a guy on the boat I know says, well, can you signal us from land with your lantern? I'm not kidding you. I have a very power. So I'll tell you what, I'll go out on a certain area, and I'll start signaling you when you're near the entrance to the harbor. This is like a few hundred yards to the right of it. So he's, all right, signals me back by email. He says, see your signal, fine. About 20 minutes later, I get a thing. We've gone aground. The captain didn't see the entrance. We're trapped here for 6 hours. So I said, oh, God, I like this guy. So I said, look, I'll tell you what. Give me a half an hour. I'll jump in my car. I'll go down to the dock. I'll get my little boat. I have three boats in my little Savage Navy. I have a little 22-foot Ranger tug, which I absolutely adore. A three-cylinder, 29-horsepower Yanmar diesel. Great little engine. And I said, I'll tug over and I'll get you with the searchlight. Well, it was like Cape Fear, to be honest with you. I forgot to bring my night vision goggles, legal, of course. They're just previous generation night vision. If I had gotten my night vision goggles, it would have been a whole different story. I would have been able to see. So my fear was I was going to run aground myself, or I was going to smash into a piling. And my poor dog, I had to wake him up. Oh, now I understand. He had a fear reaction. Savage.